Will the Jack City Council put the brakes on the RNC? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, newly minted Council President Tommy Hazzouri joins the show with his thoughts about the RNC in town, social justice in Duval, and more. Call us up now. It's 549-2937. Then later, what's the real flood risk at your property? A new online tool will help you figure that out. But first this morning, the latest on the coronavirus crisis by the numbers. Statewide, we now have 206,000 cases in Florida, and we are creeping toward 4,000 deaths in the state. In our area, we are up to 121 deaths from the coronavirus, with nearly 13,000 reported cases. Now, given these numbers, pressure is growing on local leaders to either cancel or, at the very least, downsize the Republican National Convention when it comes to town next month. They're also being asked to remedy long-standing inequities here in the city of Jacksonville at the forefront once again with the protests we've seen here and around the country after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. It's a full plate. And right now, the new leader of that body says he's got a big agenda to carry out. Former mayor, former school board member, former state lawmaker, Tommy Hazzouri is the new president of the Jacksonville City Council, and he's on the line. Council President Hazzouri, a pleasure to have you back on the show. Good morning.
Thank you, and hello, audience.
It's good to have you. What are your questions for Tommy Hazzouri? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, President Hazzouri, let me begin with the RNC. You appeared on CNN the other night and said that the city council might have to make, in your words, tough choices about this event coming to ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena in August, given that we are seeing a huge uptick in coronavirus cases and there are widespread concerns that the event will not be safe, that we should not allow people into that arena without masks and social distancing. Do you plan to exercise any oversight over this event or look to downsize it in any way? What's on your agenda for this?
As far as the oversight, absolutely. That's the responsibility of the city council for any and everything that goes on in our city relating to the health, safety, and welfare, just as it is for the mayor. But our commitment is always is the oversight of what goes on here. I think, too, that we've gotten no communication, quite frankly, from the mayor's office about what their plans are, what they're trying to do. I think they're in talking to our general counsel that they're meeting with some of the Republican National Committee attorneys, and one in particular, I think Ms. Joy Lee, who is their lead attorney on this convention. They have no information. They're trying to hammer out whatever they need to do or present if they have to the city council. Now, we've been assured by the mayor that there'll be no financial impact on the city from the standpoint of having to allocate any money. In the case of Charlotte, I think their position was that they would pay certain expenses and then be reimbursed. Well, trust is like the soul. Once it leaves, it never returns. So I'm about that. But again, right now we're just a few weeks away from the convention in August, end of August. And it concerns me greatly that that they're going to come, they being the administration, the host committee, to the city council, the hurry-up offense, just as they've been addressing this in 2 months with Charlotte and other cities that have had this type of convention.
Does it concern you enough to call for the event to be canceled? We do have an email here from Aaron Isaac, the communications director for the RNC, the host committee, and she sent this out to media, letting us know that everyone attending the convention within the perimeter, we still don't know what the security perimeter will be COVID tested. It just says tested, but I think that means COVID tested, and temperature checked each day. So that is what we are given to understand are the health precautions that will be taken. If you're allowed into the arena or outside it, You'll be tested for the virus and temperature checked. We assume that everyone inside the arena will be wearing a mask if that mask order is still in effect. Is that enough?
Assume anything, Melissa. If it were today, absolutely. The governor has a executive order out, like they would have had to apply to the shrimp, the Jacksonville shrimp last Friday. I don't know if it was rained out or not, but that they have to wear a mask. They have to have social distance, either one or the other, I think, because they're out in the field watching a movie. If it were held today, absolutely. They would have to wear a mask. They have to have social distance, which is exactly why Governor Cooper in North Carolina said that you can't come here if you don't do that. Well, they packed up their bags and said we're going to go elsewhere. Well, the New York Times had an excellent article over the weekend, and I think you mentioned it yesterday on your show, to where it stands. Right now, my feeling is that they'll continue this course of wearing a mask, mandating a mask, and as we get closer, if the virus is getting worse, then they're going to have to make a tough decision. And that decision being, are we going to have social distance? Are we going to abide what the governor said? Or is the governor going to waive that?
Well, yeah. And how about the fact, Council President Hazuri, that when the president held a rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma recently, social distancing stickers were placed on all of the seats in the arena by local officials in Oklahoma. But then the Trump campaign came in and removed those stickers so that they could get the visual of a lot of people crowded in to see the president. What if that happens here?
We would have to ask. The council hasn't taken a position, except we're very carefully monitoring. I've got our council auditor, not necessarily from a financial standpoint, but we need to know, and that's what our council auditor has.
And we're having a little trouble hearing you, sir. If you could not the best connection, but go ahead.
Council auditor, I've charged, and the council handling all things that have an impact, financial or otherwise, on the city of Jacksonville, legislation, finances, et cetera. I'm relying heavily on them working together to put some questions together for the administration, for the host committee. And this will not stand as far as the council is concerned. Can we cancel it ourselves? I don't know that we can, but
You don't know that you could call a vote, voting this up or down.
Oh, it would be a resolution. It wasn't. We could demand.
And I'm so sorry that we're really having trouble hearing you, and I just want to make sure everyone can hear you clearly. So, if you could go somewhere where maybe closer to a window or wherever you think we could hear you a little better. So you think you might, as council president, pass a resolution asking that the RNC be canceled but not bring it to the full council for a vote? Why not?
No, I don't know that we have that power. We haven't got to that point yet. In 2 weeks or so, can you hear me better now?
Yes.
As we get closer to, not closer to the convention, because we don't want to get that close without making some kind of statement. And we have not discussed it as a council to date. The mask we have discussed, we have to take a vote on it. The mayor took the initiative to take the next step, and he's done a good job in phasing us in on these things. But, you know, it's not going to be cut and dry for us. Our demand is going to have to be by pressure, by the public, and by personal responsibility on the part of the mayor, the governor, and even the president. So the president, this full steam ahead, damn the torpedoes. Well, in my judgment, that's ill-advised. He says 99% and the virus is going to just disappear, and we're going to continue the day-to-day, expecting what we get today, the new normal. And that ain't going to happen. The health, safety, and welfare of this community is our top priority, whether you're president, governor, mayor, or president of the council or the city council.
Well, then what's your reaction to the fact that this event was brought to town as a fait accompli without anyone on the city council even having the opportunity to weigh in, to take a vote on whether it was a good idea?
I think it was a giddy operation. They, we're going to have a convention here. You know, a paper called us, the New York Times. Well, we wouldn't have gotten it otherwise. We're a second-class, or second-tier, not second-class, but second-tier city. Normally, it wouldn't come to us. They wanted to come to Florida after Carolina. We were the logical choice. And it was pushed by the governor. It was pushed by the mayor, who's the former chairman of the state party. And I get all that. But this isn't about Republicans. It's not about Democrats. Democrats, I think, have taken a responsible role in breaking down the number of people and the committees that they have in the meeting spaces here. And they've done the same thing in Charlotte. They have like 168 people involved in continuing having business. And then they're going to get on a solid plane, understand, and fly to Jacksonville to hear the president. There's a lot of issues going on, and a lot of things are in the air. I'm constantly talking to our general counsel's office to see what steps we can take should the mayor or the RNC take a different position. I'm hoping that they'll continue to be responsible. I don't think you can put 15,000 people in the arena with masks, especially mandated, because I don't think a lot of them are going to adhere to it. I think they'll do the same thing that they did.
And I think what I heard you just say is you don't think everyone inside the arena would adhere to the mask mandate.
No, I don't.
And let's go to some calls now for Jacksonville City Council President Tommy Hazzuri, 549-2937, Linda in Riverside. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Yes. Councilman Hazzuri, I'm in the medical field, and I just find this unconscionable that we would even think of bringing this convention here. With the rise that we have seen in COVID and with the rise that we're probably going to see in the next 2 weeks due to the fact that we went ahead and had fireworks in six different places. We have people who have not been able to see their loved ones in nursing homes or assisted living facilities for 4 months since the 15th of March. This is unconscionable. There are people who have died alone. There are family members who are going through depression right now. There are the people in these facilities that feel totally abandoned, and some of which have mental health issues and may even feel that their relatives have just totally forgotten about them. And we were at a point where we maybe could have started before all of this opening went on and we had no mask mandate. When we opened the bars and everything else, we probably could have begun letting these people see their relatives. Maybe one relative mask, like you can have somebody go in a hospital with you right now.
Okay,
now
Linda. And I'm not sure what that noise is in the background, but I appreciate the call, Linda. That's Linda in Riverside. Council President Hazzuri, what about the polling that is in accordance with what Linda is saying? Overwhelmingly, the public here in Jacksonville does not want this event in town. They are really concerned about spread of the virus. How much pressure does that place on you as the head of this city council here to pass something or call a vote, a resolution in accordance with the will of the public?
It's my hope that I fail safe. The resolution I mentioned on the top of my head from a standpoint of taking a position. I think that Linda is absolutely right in every area that she mentioned. It's unbelievable and inconceivable that the public is, a lot of the public are not taking personal responsibility. I'm getting emails like all 18 other council members saying it's unconstitutional. Well, we have the right, as I've said over and over again, to the pursuit of happiness. And happiness for me is not getting the virus and for others not to get it. If a mask is one more tool that we can use, a mandated mask, then so be it. Now, what we can do, and I think this is important, what we can do, whenever they bring, they being the mayor's office, the administration, the host committee, brings what they want to do in writing, and that's what we're waiting on, in writing, whether it's in contract form or some kind of an agreement, then we can go over it with a fine-tooth comb and determine. If we don't support it, then it's done. And it's done. There's no question about that. And
what do you mean it's done? If you say you don't support it, it's done. What does that mean?
we won't, if we don't sign whatever they ask us to sign and agree to what they want us to do as far as approving, I don't know what we're, you know, Charlotte had to approve all the money that they received from the federal government. And right now, I guess it's $38 million that they pretty much spent. We're supposed to get maybe $50 million from the feds and some more money from the host committee.
Yeah, and we are getting a federal national security designation, too. We've learned that. But when you say it's done, what are you saying? That the city council will say, no, we won't allow the event to go forward?
If they don't approve it, then it's going to have a ripple effect on this convention, in my judgment. That's what I'm talking to the general counsel about. They still don't have a contract. They don't have an agreement. They're hammering out all of the things that they need to be doing here at the city that we have to agree to, maybe not requiring money, but requiring specific things, that putting up a fence, doing this, doing that. And I think what is incumbent on us is them not give us something, and I know they will, because they don't have enough time. Time is not on their side. And as far as I'm concerned, time is on our side as a part of the council. If they come to us with a hurry-up offense, not a one-cycle bill, but one in and out to turn around, I think you're going to have a lot of questions from the council. And in the next couple of weeks, you may have more questions from me being a little bit more outspoken about it. I've tried to take a responsible role as president of the council, as a member of the council, to work with the administration. Hopefully they'll start answering some questions, and they probably don't have some of the answers today. I get that. But, you know, at some point, it's going to be like Carol King's song, "It's Too Late." And, you know, if I had my druthers, they wouldn't have come here in the first place, neither would the Democratic Convention. So as a Democrat, I'm speaking on both sides, because I think that it's important that the primary concern of us is whatever money that we derive from the hotels and the bed tax and the expenditures that's going to be, the money's just going to be spent, is not going to be nearly what everybody anticipates because of the virus. And the other two-legged point of that three-legged table is the virus, and don't ever forget the protests.
All right. Let me get some more calls on for you as we speak with City Council President Tommy Hazzouri. Mackenzie in Mandarin. Mackenzie, you're on the air.
Hi. Speaking of questions that need answers, I have a question for you with the whole possible allow of the RNC coming to Jacksonville. Really, in the long run, what is there to gain? What is there to gain for our city in the long run, considering that, as you mentioned before, there is a virus, there is an ongoing pandemic, and what we would gain from hotel revenue, what we would gain, I guess, politically somehow by allowing this convention to go through, isn't that negligible in light of what an influx of 15,000 people to our city during a pandemic would do? We have rising numbers right now.
Okay, Mackenzie. Yes, thank you for that. Thank you for that. Council President Hazzouri.
Mackenzie, I agree. You know, nothing I think that I'm going to be hearing from the public, and I appreciate what Linda's not said and what you're saying now. You know, what price this convention? What is more important? The economy, which is going to be negligible in my judgment because of the virus. They're not going to, in the same way would have been true in Charlotte. They're not going to spend near the money that people expect. They're going to come in and out if they come here at all, and then or whoever comes here. And what price? Is our health not more important than the impact that it would have economically in the worst of times? No. Our health is more important. Our welfare is more important. The protest has not been mentioned. You know, it's nice to say you're going to have peaceful protests, but you know people from outside of the city are going to be coming here. It won't be our locals. Be outside of the city, outside around the country and elsewhere coming here because the president is a lightning rod. They're going to come back and protest, and then where they put the fencing is what I'm hearing they're putting up. It's our equivalent of a wall, I suppose, that they tried in Mexico or Texas, rather, and Arizona and wherever. But, you know, don't build a wall. Let the public, I know they have to have protection. I get that. But we're hearing rumors, and that's all it is, a third party, that the fencing will go down to about where the JSO is, around the stadium facilities, around, of course, the arena. And I don't know what they're going to call it, a protest zone or whatever it is. But those are just things that I hear, but they come from pretty reliable sources. But nothing's etched in stone yet. So until we see what they plan to do, and if they want to come and they have mandated masks, social distancing, and not what they had in Tulsa, and not what Governor Cooper expected them to have there until he put his foot down, this is an executive decision on the part of the mayor and the governor. But let me say, and let me assure the public.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I'm clear, because the mayor and the governor are saying this is happening. What I hear you saying right now as a counterweight to that is the newly minted president of the city council and also a Democrat, that on the city council, you can raise questions. You could perhaps issue a resolution opposing the event if you feel it's not safe for public health, but that you can't stop the event. Is that correct?
In my judgment, unless the attorneys tell us what holes we can run through to stop it, in my judgment, no. Now, we can raise all kinds of hell about it, but I think our leverage is going to be in approving or not approving whatever they bring to us for approval for to make this event happen.
Okay. And if I could just jump in, Council President Hazzouri, because our time with you is limited, and we are speaking with new Jacksonville City Council President Tommy Hazzouri on the show. I want to ask you quickly about a recent op-ed you penned in the Florida Times Union saying social justice needs to be a top priority in the city of Jacksonville. We've seen all the protests here, as so many other cities have, around systemic racism, police brutality. The state attorney just last night said they won't charge a police officer in the shooting of a young African-American man who was stopped by police, traffic stop. At the same time, people are worried about their JEA being shut off this week. They can't afford to pay the bills. You have a really full agenda as city council president dealing with these issues. Can you and fulfilling the promises of consolidation, which a lot of listeners have prompted me to ask you about as well, remedying longstanding inequalities in this city, how do you plan to go about that?
First thing I did is my commitment. You know, when a mayor, governor, president sets priorities, even the council president and the city council, then those priorities get done. To date, that has not happened over the years here in Jacksonville. Food consolidation promises or unfulfilled promises and what needs to be done today, not just in the Northwest Quadrant, but all over, but specifically in the north side of Jacksonville. I established a committee called Social Justice and Community Investment. And this committee consists of the five chairmen, my council chairpersons, and is co-chaired by Matt Carlucci, our finance director, Brenda Priestley Jackson, our rules chair, with an addition of our vice president, Sam Newby, as well as Randy DePore, councilwoman from the Riverside area. My commitment is total. We're not going to just walk and talk. It's time for action. We're going to have actionable items that's going to be going through a clearinghouse, which is this committee, hearing from the public, hearing from the community leaders in every phase, whether they're handicapped, whether they're educated, whether they're attorneys, whether they're civic workers, whether they're leaders in the communities, in the social issues and nonprofits and for-profits. But in the end, we're going to get out some hard-nosed legislation that's going to be sustainable. It's going to be things that we can do right away. Some things it's going to take a while to accomplish because of the dollars, and it will be expensive, but we're going to do it.
What would be an example of the kind of legislation you'd put forward in this sphere?
There are so many, and everyone has an easy one was the one that King Brooks. That's a hanging fruit type of an item that the mayor agrees to, that we go back. If we're going to be a one city, one Jacksonville, then you go back and you don't have to go to the Hyatt and with one group of people and another group at the Prime Osborne. That's going to take place. We're going to go back to being, and Martin Luther King is an example. It doesn't set the goals for what we're going to do, but it shows our commitment to moving forward. This is the other example is water and sewer, sidewalks. dollars for those areas that have been left behind. Commitments in sustainable way of having dollars available every year, surpassing any mayor, any city council, with the laws on the books to get this done. If you don't do that, then it's going to change from council to council, mayor to mayor. Their priorities will be different. There's no greater priority than to making sure that not just we keep our promises and fulfill the unfulfilled promises, but to do what's right. To do what's right. And the area that we're addressing with this committee is the area of economic development, which includes infrastructure, jobs, education, social justice issues, and law enforcement. Law enforcement is another one that I think that we could work with the sheriff, the state attorney, the public defender, the education secretary, superintendent of education of our schools, Dr. Green, to do the things together. The most important thing we're facing right now is trust. A lot of folks have lost trust in law enforcement. For one reason or another, they don't feel protected. And I want to make sure that there's a comfort feeling, that there's not just that, but things are getting done. And we're going to do an oversight with the sheriff and others to making sure that that we're doing the things, whether it's community policing, whatever. A litany of issues, but that's going to be up to the committee. I'm excited. Let me tell you, this is going to be the most actionable council that you've ever seen. And I don't want to sound like Trump. It's going to be beautiful, but it's going to be important, and it's going to be a commitment that I have made. And as you know, when I did the tolls, the odor, HRO, all these things are priorities for me. This is our number one priority, including public safety, of course, which is part and parcel of the of our Social Justice Committee.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time with us this morning. He is City Council President Tommy Hazzouri. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for inviting me.
And much more still ahead later. It's our Wild Florida. Contributor Lisa Gruba has some ideas for enjoying the outdoors while still beating the heat. But up next.
You can search by individual properties and get a 1 through 10 rating on your risk of flooding.
Assessing your home's flood risk, a new online tool, shows you how. We'll be right back.
Who is someone who most shaped your worldview? This summer, WJCT Public Media is asking Northeast Florida residents to tackle that question and others with someone who is different from them. It's part of One Small Step, a project with StoryCorps. We're pairing strangers who hold different views for a conversation. Sign up at wjct.org/OSS.
StoryCorps' One Small Step is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Dig, research, question, repeat. That's what we do every week on Reveal.
I have here thousands of pages of documentation of murder.
I'm Al Edson, host of Reveal, the weekly radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Reveal, because there's always more to the story.
Saturday at 3 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Welcome back. Well, you can learn what's new in the world of hearing loss treatment at a special virtual lunch and learn event tomorrow here at WJCT. Here's Dr. Douglas Green of the Jacksonville Hearing and Balance Institute.
We'll learn about the current state of hearing aids, cochlear implants, and various surgical treatments for ear problems. And we'll also take a forward look into things that are going to be happening in the future.
And there's a lot of technological excitement happening in this space. So check out Innovative Treatment for Hearing Loss tomorrow from noon to one, our virtual Listen and Learn series. You can register at wjct.org/events. Well, there's also a new online tool we want to tell you about right now, and it shows you how much risk your home is at of flooding. It's called Flood Factor. Here in Northeast Florida, we need to pay close attention to this. Shannon Blankenship is Advocacy Director for the St. John's Riverkeeper, and she told us more. Shannon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
There has been a lot of attention given to a new online tool, Flood Factor, where anyone can learn if they are at risk of major flooding, either now or in the future. People have been checking this out, and what are we learning about the Flood Factor risk in our area of Northeast Florida?
Well, one of the most, I would say, innovative things about using the Flood Factor tool is that you can search by individual properties and get a 1 through 10 rating on your risk of flooding based on the address that you key in. So it's very informative and very helpful for individuals looking to understand risk. I think one of the biggest changes in what you can find through the use of this tool versus just looking at FEMA-associated, risk alone is that it is going to include rainfall projections, increased rainfall projections, and changes to rainfall. And here in Northeast Florida, we know that that is going to be the most helpful for us because those are the numbers that are changing the most at this time.
Right. I mean, Duval County, Northeast Florida, according to the data here, we are one of the top 10 places in the country that needs to be concerned about flooding, right?
Yes. And, we know here in Northeast Florida that we have an abundance of waterways, fresh water, rivers, creeks, and streams, as well as our ocean. And then we know that through the projections from climate change, we are expected to see bigger storms, storms lasting longer, and storms bringing more precipitation. And so if you combine the projections of climate change with the facts on the ground here, which is that we have a lot of water and we're not updating our infrastructure in order to accommodate these changes in precipitation that we're expecting, then you see a lot of areas that are going to be continuously prone to flooding, and that flooding impacts aren't being reduced.
And tell us a little bit more about the role of the St. John's Riverkeeper in raising awareness about these issues and a response in the community.
Well, it's important to understand that every single flooding event is essentially an unmitigated pollution impact to the St. John's. So St. John's Riverkeeper has been behind wanting to see a more resilient city and communities because we want to see protection of the St. John's River as we look at this future of more storms, of more precipitation. And so we've really been on the forefront of advocating for more resilient policies because more resilient to our communities, to our vulnerable communities, is going to mean more resilience to the St. John's River, the waterway itself, and the waterway that all of us, have come to rely on.
Right. And the city of Jacksonville has been making some moves in that direction lately. And let's talk about that for a minute.
Definitely. I think one thing that the city of Jacksonville has recently done, which is just going to be absolutely vital to really trying to get a handle on this this issue of resiliency in the face of future storms, is looking to actually hire a chief resiliency officer. A chief resiliency officer would be a person that is in charge of essentially wrangling in the recommendations from various task forces and committees that have been working to identify the needed actions on resiliency in Jacksonville and can actually try to put some of those recommendations into action. It's going to take, dedicated work and having a dedicated person to do that, because one of the jobs will be to, combine the various departments that all have a role in resiliency, whether it's our parks or public works, but bringing them together to make sure that we're having a collective and unified response to these future forecasts.
It will be an important role when it is filled. And in the meantime, you can assess your flood risk at that Flood Factor website, also at our adaptflorida.org website here at WJCT. Thank you, Shannon. She's Shannon Blankenship, Advocacy Director with the St. John's Riverkeeper. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Meanwhile, here at WJCT this month, we are planning a special event looking at flooding, climate change, and coronavirus. There are connections. It'll be moderated by our own reporter, Brendan Rivers. Hey, Brendan.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Good to have you on the show. And so this will be a really interesting virtual event you'll be heading up coming up next Tuesday, July 14th. Is there a connection, climate change and coronavirus? People might not see the obvious connections, but they're there. Can you explain a little bit about what we'll learn?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to give too much away. I want people to still come to the event, but I'll try to give a little preview. I mean, there's still a lot we don't know about COVID-19, but we do know the kind of health conditions that make symptoms worse. Many of them can be linked to climate change and the pollution that's causing it. We also know that the communities that are most affected by this pandemic, the poor and often Black, Indigenous, and people of color, are also the communities that are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. There's also plenty of evidence to suggest that climate change is expanding or shifting the range of other infectious diseases and insect-borne illnesses. When it comes to direct links that we're seeing between the two crises, we do know that quarantines have led to sharp reductions in pollution, and better water and air quality has been good for health, but it's probably just a blip on the radar when it comes to addressing climate change. And so those are just a few of the things we'll discuss. We'll also explore some of the economic impacts of these two crises and what things might look like if a hurricane makes landfall while we're still struggling with the pandemic.
Right, because here in Florida, we have the triple whammy of climate change, high COVID numbers, and we're in hurricane season. So there's a lot to get into there, isn't there?
Yeah, there definitely is. And we've got a really impressive panel of experts that we'll be talking to. That I think will really shed light on these issues. So we've got Dr. Aaron Bernstein. So I mean, his resume is very impressive. Right now, he's the interim director of the Center for Climate, Health, and the Global Environment at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's a Harvard professor, and he's a practicing pediatrician at Boston Children's Hospital, who focuses on the health impacts of climate change on children. We'll also have Dr. Athena Masson. She's a Florida Public Radio Emergency Network meteorologist and an extreme weather specialist who actually started her career as a meteorologist at First Coast News here in Jacksonville.
Hmm.
And at next week's event, she'll share results from her research into how the pandemic has reduced pollution. And we'll also speak with Dr. Richard Weisskopf. He's a professor at the University of Miami and the chairman of the International Studies Department, who in the past has studied things like reductions in water consumption and the economics of Everglades restoration. And during the event, he'll share some results from new research on the economic impacts the pandemic has had on Florida communities. I'm also really excited to share that Sean LaHave, the resiliency coordinator for the Northeast Florida Regional Council, will help me host the event. So we'll kind of be tackling this together. And if people aren't familiar with him, he's one of the most knowledgeable people in the area when it comes to issues related to climate change, mm-hmm. sea level rise, and as a resiliency coordinator now, his job is very focused on this pandemic. So I think he's going to bring a lot to the table as well. So I'm very excited about the event.
It's an all-star panel as we're talking right now with WJCT reporter Brendan Rivers. WJCT is partnering with the Northeast Florida Regional Council next week on an ADAPT conversation focused on the parallels between and intersections of climate change and the coronavirus. Yes, they are interlinked. And you know, Brendan, in this time of pandemic and recession, where people are so worried about disease and unemployment, it can sometimes be a challenge to get them to focus on the more existential threat of climate change, a warming planet, and sea level rise. But these are really important concerns that we're trying to raise awareness about here at WJCT through our ADAPT platform. So this will be a way for people to kind of understand how all of these challenges are linked together. And I think here in Florida in particular, this is something people really need to pay attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I've already had a conversation with Dr. Bernstein. And one of the things that he told me that's kind of really stuck in my mind is that if we take serious action to address climate change, we're actually going to reduce the risk of and the impact of future pandemics. So just by addressing this more long-term threat, we might help prevent future things like this pandemic. And also, it's worth mentioning that there was a poll done recently at Florida Atlantic University that found the pandemic hasn't really impacted how Floridians feel about climate change. And in fact, its concern is actually on the rise. So I understand people are more focused on the pandemic right now, but climate change is still there, and it's something we need to talk about and address.
That's right. So log on next week to our virtual event, Is There a Connection? Climate Change and Coronavirus. This is through our environmental platform, adaptflorida.org. It will be moderated by our own Brendan Rivers and Sean LaHave of the Northeast Florida Regional Council, as they welcome three incredible guests, Dr. Aaron Bernstein, Interim Director of the Center for Climate Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard T. Chan School of Public Health, Athena Masson, a Florida Public Radio meteorologist and hurricane extreme weather specialist, and Richard Weisskopf, professor at the University of Miami and chairman of the school's International Studies Department. This is taking place next Tuesday night, July 14th at 7 p.m. You can register to this Zoom event by going to wjct.org/events and be part of the conversation. Hosted, as I said, by Brendan. Brendan Rivers, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to it.
Thank you, Melissa. Happy to be here.
Now, here's something else you can do on our website. You can register for free to our What's Good Wednesdays e-newsletter. It's taken off like a rocket because in this tough time with COVID-19, unemployment, all the worries and fears that all of us really, truly have, we need some good news out there, people. And so producer Heather Schatz and I every week try to round up some positive headlines for you. What's going on in this community that shows the best of the First Coast? How people are trying to help each other and support each other in this challenging time. It's a free e-newsletter. You get it every Wednesday. And it's that little pause that refreshes in your week, hopefully lifting your spirits a little bit and giving you some news you can use. So just sign up for it. If you go to wjct.org, you will see the link to sign up for What's Good Wednesdays right there on our homepage and be part of our growing community here. If you also have some news you'd like to have us serve up on our weekly What's Good menu, you can send it to us. We always value those emails. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And that newsletter will go out tomorrow. We also do some shout outs on the radio every week for What's Good Wednesdays. So if you want to be mentioned on the radio for a cool event or initiative or person, you can send us those updates through the email too. And in a moment, beating the heat this summer, Wild Florida's up next with our own regular contributor, Lisa Gruba. Don't go away.
San Jose, California was an early adopter of progressive police reforms like implicit bias training and body cameras.
And they haven't changed the reality that people are still getting killed, particularly Black and brown people getting killed here in San Jose.
Activists say the problems in the department show incremental change isn't enough. The police need to be fundamentally changed. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJZT.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Most of us are looking forward to getting our lives back to normal. There are lessons to learn from places around the globe where restrictions are being lifted. Our reporters and producers are keeping track as countries restart their economies and try to keep people safe and healthy. How other governments handle the pandemic, we keep you updated on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Senator Joe McCarthy's reckless assault in the 1950s on Americans he alleged were communists, and what Donald Trump learned from the McCarthy playbook. We talk with Larry Tai, whose new book about McCarthy draws on Tai's exclusive access to McCarthy's personal papers and medical records. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Call it a 1-2 punch for the fossil fuel industry. Plans to spend billions on a natural gas Atlantic Coast pipeline have been shelved, and a federal judge has ordered the shutdown of the Dakota Access Pipeline pending a further review. I'm Jen White. We'll talk about the impact of both decisions on our environment and our need for cheap energy, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, outdoors is better than indoors right now if you are looking to avoid COVID-19. And there are ways to enjoy a little wild Florida right now and beat the heat. It's pretty hot out there. Contributor Lisa Gruba is a Florida master naturalist and journalist. She's on the line to tell us what's wild outside this month. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Good to hear your voice. It is pretty hot out there. Do you have any ideas for how we can enjoy the outdoors while still trying to keep our cool?
Well, the best ways are to find wind, water, or air conditioning. And there's a place that I've been going to lately that you can have all three. So I've been going to this great little island that's tucked up in the northeast corner of Jacksonville called St. George Island. And it's near where the St. John's River meets the ocean. So you have the ocean breeze almost all the time, which makes it really nice to hike and be outdoors up there. It's surrounded by Fort George River to the east and Sisters Creek on the other side, which is the Intercoastal Waterway. And there are 3 miles of hiking trails, and those are always open, even during the shutdown where Kingsley Island and Kingsley Plantation that is there and the Ribault Club have been closed. The trails are always open. And of course, there's a 4-mile loop of roadway that goes around the island that you can hike there too. I've been walking there because on the east side, even when it's hot in town, you get a really nice sea breeze there. There's been kind of an ever changing array of wildflowers to see out there and shorebirds. Lately, there's been a huge flock of roseate spoonbills out in the Hexer Drive area. Mm. And those are the really beautiful, they kind of are the colors of a flamingo. They've got pink on their upper side and white on the lower side, and really beautiful bird. And so they've been out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also access the water behind the Ribault Club. The Ribault Club was this happening social club in the 20s, and it's now owned by the Park Service, and it's an event venue. Behind there is water access. You can launch a small boat. People fish there. I've gotten in the water and cooled off after a hike. There's a couple of picnic tables. So you can access the water there. And also another great way to just be in the air conditioning is there's a car tour of the island.
Hmm.
So there's a 4-mile driving loop and there are 23 markers. And you can either download MP3 files where the rangers give the history of the island, or you can print off a document describing it and go at your own pace. And that takes about 2 hours to do the MP3 files. And I'll put a link on WJCT's page and on my site at Florida Field Notes to download that. So on the just really too hot days, you can just stay right in your car and enjoy the air conditioning.
Very nice. Now, are there places to rent kayaks in the area? And how do you know where to go?
Well, there are. And I talked to Brian Burkett of the City of Jacksonville's Parks Department, and he said that that area is one of his favorite places to take out-of-town guests, because you can rent a kayak at Kayak Amelia, and you can access Fort George Island from by the Ribault Club or Kingsley Plantation, and you can go and have a picnic and get out and walk around. If you have your own kayak, you can use the boat ramp at Alamacanny or Huguenot. Those are very close by water. And the city of Jacksonville has published 3 paddling guides, and they've got one more in the works. They are laminated free guides, and you can find them at area outfitters and marinas, or you can download them online. And I'll also provide a link for that.
Okay. And you mentioned on a previous show there are kayak launches coming up for people with physical challenges. What's the update there?
This is really, really great news. The city has funding for 4 adaptive kayak launches. 3 of them are built and 1 is in the process. So they opened up Bethesda in March. That is a lake up near FSCJ North. Also, Hannah Park is also open. Those are calm lakes, and Brooks Rehab does a lot of their work out there. Another launch is at the South Bank at the school board property. That one, though, is only recommended for experienced paddlers because the St. John's River in that area has very intense currents, and sometimes you get waves with certain weather. So that's only for experienced paddlers. There will be another one coming up on a calm lake in Mandarin, and that's in the construction bid process right now.
Okay. And last month we talked about sea turtle nesting season. Listeners asked us to point out it's also shorebird nesting season, too.
That's right. And basically all the birds are nesting this time of year. And the sea turtles get a lot of attention because they have turtle patrol groups that are run by citizens who, you know, monitor the nest. The shorebirds don't get quite as much attention, but basically any bird that you see when you're out at the beach, they are nesting also. And they tend to build their nests up on the upper part of the beach or in the dunes. The thing is, the nests are so much smaller than like a sea turtle nest, and they're very well camouflaged because they're built of sand and shells. So they're hard to see. The baby chicks, when they're in the nest, are hard to see. So just be very aware that now through the end of August, they are nesting there. They will even sometimes nest out on the beach. So like if there's some debris that washes up, they call it beach wrack, maybe some seaweed or whatever, some, you know, branches, sticks.
Yeah, keep an eye out for that.
They nest in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep an eye out. And and listen every month for Wild Florida. Blogger and Florida master naturalist Lisa Vick Gruba with us. And I want to thank you. Hope to see you in person soon.
Yes, you too, Melissa. Thanks so much.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow and connect with you then. Stay safe and wear a mask, people. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.